This is CliffCentral.com.
Nick Rabinowitz has just started a show called Fortified, which is running in Johannesburg from the 16th until the 20th of January. So get it while it's hot. It's nice to see you, man.
It's been a long time.
You brought Gilly with you.
I brought Gilly.
All right, let me tell you a little bit about Gilly. Gilly Apter is a writer, comedian, director, collaborator, and she's here to look after Nick while he's in Johannesburg because he can't be left alone. He's very dangerous.
Yeah.
It's very
dangerous. Is that about right?
Très dangereux.
He doesn't know. What if he goes out in that peak cap later? No one tells him that he can't do that in Joburg.
Mm. No. And, you know, being Cape Townian, he will obviously use a minimum of water, where here he could actually use any amount of water he likes.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I flushed a wee like 3 times before Gilly came to the house.
Did it feel good? To use so much water. Come on.
We've actually a friend of mine said to me, you know, I'm very worried because like we're like commoditizing water now. And it's just our relationship to water is shifting. Okay. I don't really understand what he was
about. Well, I'll tell you what, and maybe there's a good place to start the discussion because there's a lot of ground we've got to cover, but I'm furious that the state, and in this case the city of Cape Town, government controls how much water you're allowed. You know, if the fact that they want to tell people you're allowed X number of liters a day, I understand there's a crisis, but Patricia breaking into someone's property and turning off their water, I mean, that's just such interference in someone's life by a government official. Makes me mad.
I actually told our Airbnb guests in December, I said, if you guys use more than 87, Patricia will come to the door and be like, what the fuck, you guys are wasting this water!
Now, Nick, you've made me laugh so many times you didn't even know you were making me laugh because I used to listen to you when you were on with Reedy Tlabi. For years, and it was kind of a highlight of my Friday morning because I'd have finished my show and then I'd be driving home after meetings or whatever and listen to you, and you'd manage to make all the news of the day really, really funny and interesting and all the rest of it. But I noticed in making it funny and in doing the voices and everything else, you had to have a pretty deep understanding sometimes. With all the love in the world and respect for Reedy, because she's one of the smartest people in broadcasting, and I have a universe of respect for her. But you sometimes even understood the stories better than she did. Are you one of those people who's constantly involved in, like, just information overload? You're just reading everything. You're paying attention to all the news. Is it maddening?
Well, that is all over. I've no idea what's going on now.
Really? No. Stay out of it completely.
But for that particular job, I had to.
Yeah, you had to.
So we was myself and Jill Breslin.
Yes.
Who was writing with me, and we were on it every morning.
You were writing a stand-up show every morning.
Yeah.
But I mean, you are, you don't even realize. You are a voracious, like, absorber of information.
Mm.
You're always reading something, showing something, sharing something, always, all the time.
I feel like since that ended, I was reading every day. I was reading a lot. And actually, I don't miss it too much. I miss the production of the material because that was fun. But actually,
of course, you know, if there was a scintilla of a sense of humor in Eusebius McKeyser, they would have... find a way to keep it going, but we won't go down that road. I'm interested in how you can turn something like that on or off, because I'm a voracious absorber of information too, and I love it. It fuels me. I want to live forever so I can learn as much about the world and the universe as I possibly can. To me, the whole purpose of being alive is to be curious about things.
Mm.
But you seem to be able to like pull away from it. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think probably having kids in the last couple of years has been part of that as well.
Can't concentrate.
I used to do my Skype calls with Jill probably at like 8 o'clock in the morning. And I think about doing that now, it'd just be impossible.
Even I know more about things from writing for you, like for other things.
Yeah,
I've had
really?
To know more.
Did you find you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Nick
he
will
dragged
like,
you into it.
There'll be something, and I'm like, I don't know what that is. Like, well, okay, and here's a link, here's a link, here's a link, here's a link.
Shit.
Yeah, I can turn it off, and I like to turn it off.
That's healthy.
I think going surfing, I became a bit obsessed with surfing.
I heard that about you.
So I will.
Are
do
you any
things.
Good?
I feel bad. So I've got this guilt thing where if I'm gone when my wife wakes up and there's three kids fighting and whatever, so I'll get up at 4:30 and try and be back. I'll be in the water. I'll check what time is sunrise tomorrow.
Where do you go surfing?
Well, there's multiple. Cape Town's got like 70
different
locations.
Go to different places,
locations.
But I mean, where do you like to go?
I like to go, the closest place is Musenberg, which is kind of where you start out. It's like
right.
a beginner's wave.
Okay.
But it can be good sometimes, winter particularly, if it's raining and storming and there's...
You like that?
I love that. Love that.
What about all those people who get eaten by sharks there? I mean, we hear a lot about those old
One
ladies.
One can only
who,
hope.
You know, those, but I mean, those old ladies in Fishhook who, you know, like they go down to the shore and the next thing that they
yeah.
get chomped up yeah. and then they can't find her. And
we've got these shark spotters that sit up on the mountain and you just hope the guy doesn't have a bubble ass because he's like, I don't know, not today. I just, not. What's that thing down there? I'm seeing something. No, it looks like seaweed. Those
Nick's
guys do a good job.
A new sport. You should ask him about it.
Oh yes, mm-hmm. John Vlismas introduced me to carving, which is like skating, but it's like being it's like surfing, but in a parking
skateboard.
Lot.
He's got a skateboard.
I got a skateboard.
Vlismas is one of the most bizarre people in the world. Every time he comes in here, we end up talking about everything except comedy.
Yeah,
but you know, in so many ways, like. Everybody who's funny in this country knows John Vlismas, and he's helped in some way to make – he's a very generous human being.
He is. Mm.
He seems to me to be one of those – he's like the kind of the godfather of comedy in some ways in South Africa because he made it as a comedian at a time where that was not a job.
Yeah.
And now there are so many people doing it, and that's great because we have so much talent, A, and B, there's a market for it. But it's interesting to me that someone like him – is still relevant. He's highly connected and informed. And he's so blasé about it. He's kind of, yeah, you know, there's this one and that one. And I try to do this with this guy. And we put up a show here. And
it's because he's ahead of everything. He's always been ahead of us. He was ahead of us then when he started doing comedy. He's ahead of everyone now. He's always ahead, like by a few paces. In the thinking,
I watched him,
in information. He's always ahead.
We did this gig in Durban. It's a couple of club gigs.
Yeah.
And that's where we started skating. He's like, do you want to go skating? I was like, yeah. He's like, I'll pick you up at 5. We went to meet this guy called Spider Murphy, who's like, excuse me, Gilly, has no interest in this, but he's like a surfboard designer.
It's
Spider.
I have no interest. I'm just concerned with like middle aged skateboarders.
Anyway, so we went, help. And then Spider said, come and meet us at 5 on the Golden Mile. We'll skate and then we'll surf. And then when he did that. But the gig, it was I don't know, 150 people in a place called, I don't even know where that place is, Scott's Hills, I don't know, whatever. And John was emceeing, and he worked this crowd like only John can. And he had no material, just like working this crowd for, I don't know, an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like jaw-dropping. And some audience member, and I was another comic. It was like a young comic came to him afterwards and was like, you, like that's amazing. Like, how did you? And he was like, oh, I don't know. Like, I ran this club for like 10 years. And yeah, so it was kind of, yeah.
But he does something which I think a lot of people struggle. He's so supremely focused when he's up there.
Yeah.
Like, yes.
I would imagine that you would get very distracted. I mean, I'm not saying you're an ADHD sufferer, but I would imagine you are the kind of person, your brain is firing and many different directions at the same time. Do you have to concentrate really hard?
I don't, but I have to really work at the improv. Like, he just has this genius mind. He just trusts himself fully as well. You can see he knows he's out there surfing the thing and it's going to all come together. And it just does every single time.
But I mean, if you went to the underground 15 years ago, he was doing it then.
Yeah.
He's so proficient at it. Don't forget that he's been doing
it
for so... Exactly. He's mastered the art of talking to an audience. Absolutely mastered it. Even then, he was so good that you would be terrified. I would be terrified. Even if you were in the 5th row of the underground in Melville, you were shaking.
Yeah.
If you made eye contact with that man, you were dead. You were dead. That was 15 years ago.
Even if you were next door eating like one of those bad... What did they serve there?
It was like a Jamaican restaurant.
You know Nina Hasty, right?
I do.
Yeah, she's a friend of yours.
Yeah.
She's a nutcase.
She gets this a lot.
No, I mean, because Nina's been here a lot, and we shared a show here for a long time.
Yeah, Nina's wonderful.
I mean, that she's off the chain, that girl.
She is, because her head is bouncing around all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's got a million different thoughts coming at her all the time.
Are you guys friends with a lot of other funny people? Like, is this something that happens because it's in your kind of, you know, it's in your orbit the whole time that these are the people who are around?
Yeah.
So you end up being friends with them, you end up getting to know a lot of them, or do you consciously try not to be just friends with comics?
I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I'm newer at this than Nick. I'm like 2 and a bit years in. And one of the things I never expected was to suddenly have this community of people around me. And it's because you're spending time with people when you are at your most vulnerable. And you're only on stage, you're in a lineup show night after night. You're only on stage for like 10 minutes, an average of 10 minutes, let's say. And the rest of the time you're with these people.
Yeah.
You know, you're building up to a show with them and you're coming down from a show with them. And like,
and not forgetting your phone, because you're on your phone actually the entire time.
How many WhatsApp,
even when you're on stage.
How many WhatsApp groups are you on?
No.
Minimum, bare minimum.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm on like, I don't know, 20, and I have to remember when I find something funny, forward that to these ones.
Getting out of the WhatsApp group is the most terrifying thing.
Well, if you leave, there's always like a lot of talk about you once you've left.
And you can't surreptitiously leave. You can't be like, 2 a.m., I'm going to leave.
No,
I like to make grand statements before I leave.
You say something outrageous.
Yeah. Just like leave them with something huge. Like, I'm pregnant, out.
I had a problem, just coming back to what you were talking about now, because with starting a family and suddenly having to get up early in the morning and stuff.
How old are your kids?
My kids are 8, 5, and 1. No, not one. Is it? Yes, one.
Who knows how old that kid
We're
is.
Still in months with that one. The third child, you never know exactly what's going to happen. But I stopped hanging around clubs and things. I would do my thing and then go home. And then people would, like KG said to me the other day, you know, people don't really know who you are.
And that's insulting?
They got the wrong idea about you. Maybe just spend a bit more time. Maybe have a drink. Maybe, you know, share with them.
Maybe I'll go home to my 3 million children.
I like talking to comics because I do think that most of them, there are obviously exceptions, but most of them are really thoughtful people. You know, they put a lot of time and effort into kind of observing and analyzing the world and observing and analyzing people.
Mm.
And human behavior is part of what you feed on when you're up on that stage, right? So when I talk to really, really funny, smart people like you guys, I like to find out what you think about not the obvious stuff, the politics, the economy, the society, but how you feel about things like, you know, therapy and drugs and recreational activities, like you were saying just now, surfing and skating and shit, because those things are often you're not asked about them, and you've probably spent a lot more time thinking about those than you have about the politics.
Yeah,
yeah. Like just earlier, I was telling Nick that I've realized after knowing him for many years, today I realized that Nick has got an obsession with medical practitioners.
Really?
I didn't know this.
Are you aware of this?
He wasn't until
I married one.
Yeah.
Right.
Actually, I became friends with a medical, she was probably a student in about 1999, because that was my last year at university. And she had a big impact on my life and introduced me to a lot of other medical students, one of which was my wife, who I'd actually known since we were 12.
Wow.
Yeah. Have I ever told you the story about the first time I met Debbie?
No.
It was in a religious instruction class.
Jewish school?
No, but
Christian school?
But they had like 12 Jews and they sent us away. That wasn't the class part. But the Mrs. Chait did Jewish religious instruction to my friend David's mother. And I'll never forget seeing Debbie Becker at the time across the room.
Mm-hmm.
And she had these little legs that were dangling that couldn't quite reach the floor. And I looked at her and I thought to myself, that girl is fucking short. And then we got married like 20 years later. But so I met all these medical students, Debbie being one of them, and married her. And then, yeah, I guess.
But, like,
I was talking to you that my dad was 32 years older than my mom. And from a very young age, like 2 years old, he was in and out of hospital, like a lot. He had chronic heart condition.
Oh, like health problems.
And triple bypasses. And
not because he was a medical practitioner.
No, he wasn't. But my mom became obsessed with medical practitioners because they were like going to save his life or not. And so I spent a lot of time around this. But we haven't quite developed this idea, but we're going to explore it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One day it's an osteopath.
But,
another day
hang on.
And
that could also be like a Jewish thing.
We are leaving some room for that.
My health. You got to check in. And also, what Jewish kid isn't brought up with the idea that being a doctor is a stable, safe career option? And a lot of...
Not me, I can tell you.
No, well, clearly. I mean, you must have been a huge disappointment. But it must have been something in maybe in the genes that you weren't aware of. And maybe that attracts you.
Possibly. Actually, my dad had a very insecure financial life because he decided at 40, I only discovered this recently, in a letter from a very good friend of his, which actually was a foreword to a book about my dad. That the doctor told him that accountancy was giving him a rash.
What?
Yeah. I don't know. He was stressed.
First of all, there's a book written about your dad?
No, we are in the process of writing
it. You're writing one?
Yeah. So he gave up accountancy at 40 and took up pottery when nobody... Jesus. I mean, this was 1962 maybe, 1960. Nobody really did that professionally. No. And he found a little farm. It was just outside of Cape Town. He built himself a little workshop and had like a one-bedroom little cottage where he actually had to sublet that cottage in about 1962 because he didn't have enough money, moved into his kiln, slept in his kiln for 6 months.
Well, not in the kiln.
In the kiln. Not when it was...
Not when it's hot.
No.
Unless it was winter. A really serious winter.
This is a very eccentric...
Like some bad Holocaust.
Hang on.
Yeah?
This is a very eccentric human being, father.
Yeah.
Do you see any of that in yourself? Do you recognize it? I mean, did you know your dad well enough to...
Yeah.
I mean, were you observant of him in that way?
I mean, my dad basically lived a walk... Sorry, lived. I mean, if he could have, he would have worked 7 days a week. He loved what he did, and he had to walk through the forest to get there. So it was like a 10-minute walk through the forest. If I wanted to see my dad, I would walk through the forest.
Sounds like a grim fairy tale about to start.
Yeah.
If you want to see your dad, you got to walk through the forest.
Yeah, I just take my friends up the mountain. I had like a kind of...
Okay, but you know how they say when we get older, we start to resemble our parents. So do you look sometimes in the mirror and see and notice behavior of yours that's a little bit like his?
Yeah, for sure. I looked at some pictures on stage the other day where I dressed up as a drunk 70-year-old man. Do you remember that character?
Yes.
Like, oh my God, that's my dad.
Sometimes Nick.
He wasn't the drunk part.
Sometimes Nick will wake up in the middle of the night and find himself fashioning a pot.
Oh yeah, sure. That's likely. God alone knows what he's using to fashion the pot when there's no clay around. That would be terrifying. Yeah. Okay, so one of the things that I think a lot of people love about you, because it's something that you do expertly, is your impersonations. I used to do them at school because it got me attention and girls would like think it was funny, and it was a way to be funny, and it's not really you, it's a character. So if the character says something crazy, you don't have to be responsible for it. Is there any of that, or is it just being brilliant at impersonations and using comedy that you've already written as Nick that you then put into these characters?
That's an interesting question. I guess I also started doing it. I copied a friend of mine. Because often with impersonations, it's quite difficult to find the handle or the thing. The hook is actually the word, the hook. And this friend of mine, Wayne Maris, he introduced me to various characters that he did very well. And then I just sort of copied his impersonation of Tutu or whoever it was, and then just sort of developed it further.
Because it is sometimes easier to do a secondhand impersonation. Yes. Like I saw a guy doing a Trump impersonation, and I was able to extract what I needed from that and
correct.
Do my own version of Trump way better than if I watched Trump.
Yeah. That's because those couple of hooks are what you need to...
It's like a caricature. You know, the great cartoonist, he makes the nose just a little bit bigger or the ears or there's something. And then when you see it, you're like, ah, that's the thing that stands out. So when you hear it, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah. And then when I was working on the puppet show, ZA News, often on...
You did a lot of characters.
At one point, they were just bringing in new characters all the time. And I would have to just, you know, suddenly come up with
make up a voice.
And they would somebody. Do, but I was going to talk about that show as well, because I was writing on that show, and what they would do is they would find a thing. Like, they would find a thing, like...
That was often a physical thing,
he would always talk about animals, you know, like the eagles, you know, you're as strong as an eagle, whatever it was, he would always bring in like dangerous...
And Guido's thing was, no,
yes. And there was a time where I was writing for the show where there were some characters that I'd never heard speak, but then I would hear the real person on the radio and only recognize them because they sounded like the puppet. You know what I mean?
But I mean, Agri Lonake, talk about secondhand, learning from someone second. That guy is just masterful. I mean, and no, people don't know who he is, but he's like the king in South Africa.
Do you get sick of doing them? Because people go, oh, Nick, do this.
Yeah. I mean,
it gets annoying, right?
I did a gig the other night.
Can we have Chuchu? I mean, you haven't done Chuchu.
God.
It's in the middle of the thing.
And I don't like people doing, there's certain tired old ones. Like, I don't want to hear anyone doing a Mandela voice ever again. It's just done.
Yeah.
And even if you do it beautifully, it's done. It's no fun in that anymore.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever going to get that way with your tutu. But I mean, there are possibly some that you're sick of that we are not yet.
Yeah, I think I probably feel sick of most of them.
But you have done, you've been doing them for a long time. And, and obviously when you learn a new one, then you prefer to do the new ones than the old.
Yeah.
I think it's whatever serves the material that you're doing.
Yes, you know? Yes.
Do you feel like it has to be included in your stand-up?
I did for a while. Like with Trump, for example, in the beginning, I thought, I've got to do Trump. And I just, I tried it a few times and it was lame. Then I watched Riyad Musa doing it and he did it brilliantly. And then I thought, well, maybe I don't have to.
Mm. And you know what it is? It is about like what's informed. So if you're doing a new show, there might be a character at a call center or a character, you know, like more street characters that you do.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you feel like you have to bring in like famous characters.
Okay, let me ask you this, because a lot of like identity politics, strident leftists will say that when you put on a generic black accent, which you have to do from time to time for some of these street characters. I mean, you might have someone in your mind, but that in some way is racist. It's like blackface if you were doing visual art.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a response to that that's sensible?
I like to make it a specific person that I'm, you know, impersonating or satirizing or whatever you want to call it.
That's
so
exactly
that it's not about but it's about that person. But it's still open to... People might still listen to that and go, oh,
I mean, like if I think of a DA supporter, I know how DA supporter sounds.
Yeah. Also, I mean, I think about it a lot. And I also notice it's interesting when a black comic does blackface. Often, in terms of a voice or whatever, often actually their whole act could be that.
Yeah.
I know certain comics that like come off stage and they're like, oh my God, that audience was... But on stage it was like, oh, it's like a whole different... persona, which is kind of you have anyway.
Well, you could see even, and I shudder to say it because, you know, if you're a white guy and you say these things and you're just observing, it could be misinterpreted that you're trying to find a handle on somebody. But with Musi Maimane, you see how he turns on the black when he's doing a whole lot of, sorry about that. You could see when he turns on the black, when he's got a black crowd and then he turns it down for the white crowd. You're like, I don't know if I like that. I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with that. Like, you know, you're kind of hamming it up for us.
Yeah, I think a lot of I know a lot of the black comedians take him to task on that thing. Yeah,
I don't know if it's fair either. Maybe he feels like, you know, when he's around certain people, he can be a certain side of himself, and other people he has to be a different part of himself. I don't know. I think it's cruel to infer what you believe into what he's doing without having evidence. You don't know his thoughts. Right? And that's so much of the problem that social media brings into our world these days. And I want to know what you think of this as well. If I say something on social media, or if you say something to anyone else, you can't really hear the tone. And sarcasm and irony are, for some reason, at a real premium these days. You can't say things in a sarcastic or ironic way anymore without actually saying I'm being sarcastic and ironic. Because people will take it and they'll make it theirs, and they'll infer whatever prejudice they have into that. And before you know it, and as a comic, this must be frustrating as all hell, because you kind of want to use social media as a marketing tool, but you really probably don't like it because you don't have any control of the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I have an aversion to social media for that reason, and I end up just posting stuff of my 5-year-old in a leopard print leotard with no pants on, having a tantrum because his brother didn't play Marco Polo correctly with him in the swimming pool.
No, but then you could even get into shit for that. That's the irony of this.
You can't see his penis. You saw the video.
Yeah. Listen.
I saw it.
This is very frustrating, though. And when you're doing a gig, if someone... Because people record everything these days. You can't even stop them some of the time. You say to them, no recording, no audio, no. This is a show. Sit down and enjoy the show. Some idiot will take a clip out of context that's 2.5 seconds long. They'll put it on social media, and the next thing, Nick Rabinowitz is being mean to Muslims.
Yeah. Oh, right. The whole the Joey thing. It's very interesting. I think it must be extremely challenging if you're a big comic like you are, I don't know, Chris Rock or someone, where you need to work on your material for months before it's ready.
Yeah.
And
for like a special and
for a special. And they can't do it anymore because you're in a club just working on that bit.
Yeah.
And someone's filming you.
Yeah. That's why also you get like huge shows now, like Dave Chappelle, where you go see him at Radio City Music Hall and you have to submit your phone at the entrance.
Right.
You lock it up in a bag.
Yes.
Like it's security locked and
Mentioned Chris Rock. He and Seinfeld, they won't do colleges in America anymore because everything's about me and my feelings. So if Jerry Seinfeld criticizes the color blue in a joke, which is just about the most banal thing you could possibly do as a comic, someone in the crowd who's wearing blue is going to get up and start shouting at him, "You're disrespecting me. You're a misogynist." And before he knows it, he can't even complete his act because of some slacktivist in the crowd. Now, that worries me from the point of view that we've become, and I don't say we in any general sense. I mean that there are people in society who have become so strident about the way they see the world and their own feelings about the world that any speech, any thought that is in contravention of that is, in their opinion, hate speech.
Yeah.
And for comedy, this means a very infertile environment.
Mm.
It's a bit of a nasty place to try and grow jokes.
Yeah, I think we're still very fortunate here. I did some stuff in London recently and worked with some English comics here, and they were like shocked at some of the things I'd said. The one was actually a religious Jewish show that I did. I actually supported this guy. Mm-hmm. He came out from England, and I did like 10 minutes. And I've got this gag about Trump coming into power and suddenly all this anti-Semitic stuff. There was that march in South Carolina, wherever that was, Charlottesville. And then there was people spray painting stuff. And at one point, there was a sign spray painted on a university that said "fuck the Jews," and so I'm talking about this at the gig, and I was like, you know,
that was here in Joburg.
That was also in Joburg. Yeah. I mean, it's a very mainstream thing to think. I'd said
anti-Semitism is pretty mainstream.
Oh yeah, I'd said, and she'd say, "No, I'm very worried because it's in our community in Pennsylvania. It's in the local university. I'm very worried." But then I'd said, "Well, did that happen? How do we know? Is it fake news? Right. How can I trust? What is it? Just is it marketing? Is it a sign outside a Jewish brothel? They're just saying, 'Come inside, fuck the Jews.' We don't know. We don't know anything anymore." And this guy was careful. Like, "You could never say that in front of rabbis in England."
Yeah.
Well, you can't say. You're not going to do stuff in front of rabbis in England. What I find interesting is like we, fuck the Jews. No, that's not going to work in front of rabbis in England.
That's not going to work.
Or rabbis anywhere.
It'll work.
They were rabbis.
It'll work.
In fact, the rabbi phoned me on my way home from the gig to say, "This guy's dying. Can you come back?" I'm the opening act.
You're joking. Wow, that's
what do you want? Name your price.
Really?
Not in that accent. But name your price, Nick. Well, we got to do something. This guy's dying.
Is he from Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
We went to shul in Brooklyn.
We did.
Together. Wow. We went to like the Chabad headquarters, which I don't know how you explain Chabad, but it's like,
it's like the
Jewish sect,
almost
I guess,
a sect. Yeah,
it's very big.
It was crazy.
It was crazy.
I heard a great thing. Do you know what Jon Stewart's first ever joke was when he went up on stage as a stand-up comedian? Like when he was just starting out. He went up and he explained in New York on 47th Street with all the diamond shops, you've got the Hasidim and they, you know, they've got the tzitzit and the payas and the zotel on their head and all of that stuff. And they all come out of their shops at the same time when the shops close at night. And he said, it's chaos, like 47th Street, you just can't move. And they're all going to go and get supper or lunch or whatever it is. He says, you know what you call it? Yidlock.
That was his first
joke, and nobody, he says, no one laughed. Didn't understand.
That's such a classic joke.
Yeah. But that's a good, the Yiddish, Gareth.
Very nice terminology.
I didn't even know this term for the, what was it? The yotel. The yotel. The zotel.
That's a zotel.
I never heard that.
I never heard it before either.
Have you ever heard of that, they say, chaza mitzotel? It's like if someone dresses up, but they still look like chaza.
Chaza, right.
Like who
are these Jews that are teaching you this
stuff?
I've
got a lot of Jews.
There's some good Jews you got there.
I've got some great Jews in my life.
I can hear.
I'm very pleased.
You can hear when someone's got great Jews.
Absolutely. You can always hear when someone's got a good Jew in their life.
Do you think that things like anti-Semitism are on the... I mean, you said the most depressing thing just now, Gilly, about how you think that the world is on the brink and we're all going to die at any moment and it's more dangerous than it's ever been. Like, I wake up in the morning and I go, I genuinely believe that this is the best time to be alive.
Oh, yeah,
I don't live like that, though. I'm just like saying everything because we have...
There's a word for that in Yiddish. You're a fecriminus.
What does that mean?
Yeah, it means you're a misery. You're hard to get along with.
Something I've never been accused of.
So you don't really feel that way?
No, you know what it is? Because we were talking about like temperature and how close we are to the sun and all that stuff. Because we have access to so much information. Don't forget who brought this up, okay? Who told us first thing how close we were to the sun.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like we have access to all this information, and so we always know about everything. We know how... We're always being told how everything is on the brink.
You preferred it when you were in blissful ignorance.
Absolutely. I know, but that's how I choose to live, in blissful ignorance.
No, I don't believe you.
Yeah,
you're
absolutely.
Not, no, you know what's going on in the world.
Yeah,
you're
but
not,
I mean, you can't live ignorant. Like you know what's going
no,
on in the world.
No. Look, they're levels, but you're not willfully ignorant. You don't go into a situation going, I'm not going to learn about this because I know everything.
No,
I need to
but I do like think you really can't live every minute like you know every single thing that's going on, or your head will explode.
Okay, so then to get back to the point, do you think like things like racism and anti-Semitism and sexism and these things, which are all in your face every day because there's someone somewhere being like that or someone feeling like they're having that done to them?
I was told I was doing that this morning on a radio interview.
You were called what?
Yeah, by the presenter. He said, don't you think that's a bit sexist?
Who said that to you?
A radio presenter whose name I don't remember. But
was it an interview?
Yeah, it was an interview. I said to him, he said... I don't know what he said, but I said, I'm here for the week. This is the longest time I've done a show in Joburg for 8 years since we had kids. And I feel bad because my wife's at home with the children. But I said to her, when I'm back on Sunday, you can go and do something nice for yourself. Go and have a mani-pedi or a spray tan or
like
a boob
that,
job.
And he said that's sexist?
I think he thought the boob job part was sexist.
I think certain people shouldn't be allowed to participate in humor.
Like I agree.
There are some people you've got to exclude. Like, some stuff is not for everyone.
It's not. You know? It really isn't. But coming back to this conversation, because it's interesting, because statistically or factually, we are living in the best time to be alive for human beings. Less disease, war, famine, blah, blah, blah. But there are people, and it's probably because of media, who think it's the worst.
Yeah, but there are also, look, there are certainly hateful, shitty people in the world. I mean, there probably are still enclaves of white people around who don't just talk about how much they don't like black people, but actively do something. Like they'll, you know, shoot someone or, you know, go out and torment some black guy or shout at their worker or whatever and demonstrate actual racism. But I think... It would be society in general will frown upon that now, where before there might have been some tacit support for it.
I still think there's a lot of tacit support.
Do you think so?
Yeah, absolutely.
See, this is you being a fecriminus again. Why do you say that?
Because I see it. I see tacit support. I see it. I see it in and it's subtle. It's much more subtle, and because it's less.
You're not
acceptable.
Going to enough Shabbat dinners, guys.
Yeah.
Well, you go to more. Listen, I don't really feel like we've got reasons to grind axes with each other like we used to before. No. There's a lot more information now, so people share a lot more. There's a lot more conversation. There's crossing of barriers that might never have happened before. I mean,
there is.
You know,
but
Muslim
I think we
friends
can't...
and Jewish friends and atheist friends and everybody kind of can talk without having to get to...
everything on extremes. You know what I mean? We're talking about living in a middle ground place, yeah. right? With like on an everyday level.
Yeah.
And you see stuff. You see stuff all the time. You see you see things that are on like an, the edge of racism or sexism.
Yeah, aren't we just looking for them?
I don't
because
think so.
We don't actually
I mean,
fight anymore. Like we're not actually fighting. You see those assholes that you mentioned earlier in North Carolina who did that tiki torch march or whatever. Yeah. And they spray. It was such a small group of people comparative to the whole population of the United States. But there seem to be people who want to say, look, racism's still alive, as if, because that for them gives a lot of them meaning. Like if Al Sharpton didn't have a racist or two to point to, Al Sharpton wouldn't have anything to scream about from the podium on Sunday.
But that's why I'm saying you can't look at the extremes for this argument, because for me it's sort of a waste. That's what entertainment and news and all that stuff is doing. It's polarizing us using all this information, right? Mm. For me, it's more interesting thing is the stuff that goes on in like the day to day, and it's very subtle. You can't always tell exactly if it is one thing or another.
While we were skating on the Golden Mile. Last week, Wednesday, I met a car guard just in front of, you know, where Ushaka Marine World is.
Yes.
Yes. And this, I think, sort of embodies the sort of paradoxical nature of this whole thing, where this guy, who must be in his 60s, a white guy, no teeth, and he carries around a hockey stick and wears green Crocs. And I had a conversation with him, and he was like, you know, black guys are coming here, so I carried a hockey stick with a Moody's guy. He was a stone and the K word. And I was like, oh, and who's the other car guy? No, that's Tabo. He's actually my housemate. I'm not a racist. Actually,
I'm not a racist.
I live with Tabo. She's actually very clean.
So he hates black people, but he loves Tabo.
Yeah.
The two of them are good. You see, I think if we look for it, you'll find it. But this is also what bothers me about when you say something funny. There are going to be people who are determined to not find it funny and who are determined to find a reason that it's cuck.
Yeah.
You can't do anything for those people, right? We can't.
You can't.
We can't really. Can't pull
the
them
worst
along.
Is when they're in your audience and you can see them in row three.
Do you obsess over those ones?
B2. Yeah, you do.
That's
do
the
you
one you look at. You're not even looking at the ones who are having a great time.
Look at that. I did a corporate recently where I had one of those, and I eventually I was like, well, what is it? Like, is it a language issue? Are you not understanding? Are you from another country? What? And she had this face. She just scowled at me. And I did that thing where you go, oh, I will by the end of tonight. And then I realized it's not going to happen. I sat down and the CEO said to me, there are moments. And
well,
I was like, what are you going to? And he's like, don't worry, it's fine.
It's very hard because you look like across, you know, in an audience, you can't control who's there. Like I did a gig in Cape Town recently and I didn't know. And I arrived at the gig and it was just an all Muslim room. Right, and
that's so exciting. But what a challenge!
No, you know what the thing is? It's actually not a challenge because if I'm in a room, if I'm in a room of that I know all religious people of any religion, I know that there's a line that I'm not going to cross. Do you know what I mean? And it's clear to me what to do.
See,
whereas when you're in a room of people who might have
some feelings of. You knew what you shouldn't do.
Yes.
But did you know what you should? Like, I would have been nervous about what I should be doing with that audience, not what I shouldn't. Because the shouldn't, you kind of, yeah, okay, that's fair. You know, there is a line. And particularly if the line is blasphemy.
Yes, exactly.
You kind of know not
so
to cross
I'll tell you, like, as a Jewish person, the first time I did that, the first time I went into a room full of Muslim people, I was for comedy and I got introduced on stage. And what was amazing is that I was talking about, like, you know, being from a Jewish community and it's conservative. And suddenly, for the first time, my material actually landed better than it does in a room of like Anglo-Saxon sure. white people because well, they got exactly what I was talking about.
There's a lot of duplication yeah. And collaboration there.
The pig stuff is what a great tranche of material
that provides.
Oh, just do my pig stuff.
I was with my kids on Sunday and they were asking about, I don't know who brought this up, at the dinner table. My mother-in-law was very upset. Mm-hmm. Started talking about pigs eating humans. Have you ever heard of these situations?
Yeah, isn't it more of a certain urban legend that pigs can devour a human?
Maybe it was the farmer was dead, he had a heart attack, he keeled over. I mean, my mother-in-law said, can we please, Jake, can we change the conversation? Please, we're eating it. And I was like, sure. I wrote some pig jokes a while ago. I was like, well, pigs eating humans, that's the first sign of the apocalypse. And then you get culpable hamas. And like all this, I was, where did these pig jokes come from?
That's fantastic.
They're terrible.
You know that they're
wrote them for that exact
audience. They said they're smart as a three-year-old child.
Yes.
Adult pigs. And the reason.
So pretty dumb.
Well, no. You know three-year-old.
My three-year-old's WhatsApping.
That's smart.
Your three-year-old is another kind of person.
I read some very interesting literature on this, actually. Pigs, the smell of human burning is very similar to the smell of pork being cooked. And that's possibly one of the reasons that they didn't like eating it in Judea. And also, it wasn't completely outlawed. It was for the priests only. And, you know, in Borneo, they call us the long pig.
So only the priests could eat pig?
Yeah, because they found middens. Because, you know, people used to shit in a certain area, right. And they'd eat in a certain area. Yeah. And you didn't really mix the two. And they'd found in the temple areas where the priests, there were often, you know, sort of porcine remains included, but not with the ordinary folk. So it was kind of a special ritual meat. And because of the firemen, if you ask a fireman, particularly one who's been into a building where people have died, they will tell you that it smells a little bit like when you cook bacon.
So if we have Rabbi Green over for Shabbos.
What are you trying to say?
No, don't try it. Please don't upset everybody. But isn't that interesting?
That is fascinating.
You get into the stuff and it's quite extraordinary. Like in Borneo, they eat people. They used to until a very short while ago. And they called us humans the long pig.
The long pig.
Oh.
I know some people who look like the same height of a pig.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I was talking to someone about this morning is octopus. Very smart things. Octopus, they say, by far the cleverest animal in the sea.
Yes.
And we should maybe think twice about calamari.
Hmm.
Yeah, if we're going to be... And I don't really love pork. I've got to be honest. I'll indulge in some bacon from time to time, but don't put anything more in front of me. I'm not going to enjoy it.
Don't make us incriminate ourselves, Gareth.
No, you don't have to. I'm just saying.
Okay, we're not going to talk about bacon.
I've made a decision to move away from pork, and I think I must make the decision about calamari. I'm feeling bad about these octopi.
And
apparently
humans.
They're very sentient, smart, and clearly they have some level of sensitivity.
Wasn't there an octopus that predicted the FA Cup winner 2 years ago?
And where the World Cup would be held and all that other things.
Yeah.
They're quite smart things, those. I love sort of finding out that there are reasons for us to be funny about stuff rather than reasons for us to be prejudiced about stuff too. Like you mentioned this room full of Muslims and the room full of, you know, sort of people who also come from a conservative kind of religious cultural background. Gives you something to attach to.
Mm.
But I love it even more when we can get to a point where you are allowed to treat nothing as sacred. And I suppose that happens less and less. Maybe it's happening in WhatsApp groups. We spoke about those earlier. You know, there's some WhatsApp groups I'll send just about anything to, as crude and vulgar as it may be. Other ones that you would avoid that for.
I mean, I think South Africans in general are very conservative. And so even as comics, we're conservative.
You think?
Yeah, I think so. As writers and comics in South Africa, we are conservative. We come from a conservative culture. We don't really push the line as much as we think we do. And the audiences are conservative as well, obviously.
And it's also because, it's that you know, double-edged thing where, you know, is the audience going to respond to the, if I, maybe I won't go there.
So are there any areas that you just actively avoid, like race, politics, sex?
I think it's more how you religion. Treat. It's more like how you treat and deliver the material. I was watching this guy called Stuart Lee. I don't know if you've watched any of his stuff, but you would enjoy. He's an English comic. And he, I don't know how to describe his work, but a lot of it's sort of anti-comedy.
It's very meta.
It's meta.
Yeah.
And he does stuff like, he did this whole thing about, what was the thing about the foot? It was a pirate.
He does a joke and then he breaks the joke down.
Yeah, and then he, and the pirate writes a letter to Pirate World saying, what kind of pirate world is this? My foot. And then he explains to the audience, he's like, I heard some of you got that joke, but some of you need to just stay up to date with this show. Like, I'm not going to explain every joke. I'm not gonna spoon feed you with Michael McIntyre's warm diarrhea. I've not noticed anything about your lives. It works because that audience, he's cultivated that. There's an audience for that. Here, people would be like, "What is he?" No, just start with the jokes now.
It's not direct enough.
Yeah.
And you can tell when you go into an audience. Okay, so you need to hear some like typical.
You
know,
let me ask you something, because we do. This brings up a whole frustration of mine. Is this lowest hanging fruit discussion? Someone like Leon Schuster, God bless him, made a lot of money in the 80s and 90s and even into the 2000s, making these movies which were kind of about as basic as you can get. And I have the world of time for him. He's a very nice man. I've sat with him and had really interesting conversations. He knows what he's doing, and it appeals clearly because it sells tickets like hotcakes, right? But it's this lowest hanging fruit thing. And if you want to make your comedy, or you want to make your product, you want to make your show, whatever it might be, a more sophisticated thing, and you want to appeal to those people, you have to accept that you're going to lose the majority of South Africa's audience. Is that something that you often try to figure out when you're putting a show together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. Definitely.
And do you try to meet halfway, or do you go, fuck it. If I get 20 people here, that's the 20 people I want.
Well, it's interesting. I did a show that totally bombed about, when was the power struggle? About a year, two years ago. try to blank that out.
The power struggle?
We called it the power struggle. It was like about the history of energy, our use of energy.
Oh, okay.
A man's
thing. No, I was just curious about the title.
Yeah, it was all of it. And we had like guys on bikes powering the lights, except they weren't. And people actually emailed me the other day, can we get those guys who powered? I was like, that's just bullshit. We didn't actually do anything. But we actually did. We ran something of biodiesel. Didn't we have like a biodiesel
something
generator?
Like
yeah,
this.
We had a biodiesel generator. Yeah. Ran the sound of. Anyway, but people didn't get it. People didn't get it. I had people, the theater management telling me, you've really, you know, it's damaged your reputation. Yeah.
Oh, no.
And da, 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 da. And it was like,
that's
wow, okay, because I've spent years training my audience that this is what they can expect, and then you do something totally, it's not totally left field, but
no,
it was.
No, but you did something a little
unusual.
Bit different, and then
they went, huh? Some people loved it, but most of the sort of mainstream audience were like, what the hell was that?
And then is there pressure also for both of you to be such commercial successes, or to be so? What's the word I'm looking for? Like accessible, that you can get a TV special, or that you can get some kind of mainstream media gig, which can guarantee you sort of the rent money or whatever. Because that's a temptation for a lot of people in entertainment. It's not just in comedy.
I mean, I've been doing I don't like to tell anybody about this show, but it's a TV show on SABC3.
And, say it very quietly and no one will know.
It's called Tires and Briars. And I feel, they're deeply embarrassed about lots.
This is a show about cars, cuisine, essay culture. 20
minutes of the 24 minutes. And and I work quite hard on the material.
Sure.
And it's all cut. Like 90% of what I say is cut, and then it's like they just cut out the punchline, and they'll just have me saying, these cocktails are really nice, Hez.
Which you might have been, might as well have done on top billing. Right?
But part of me enjoys it. But part of me is like, why are you doing this? But you kind of do it because, you got three kids at Herzliya.
Yeah. No, you got to do what you got to do. And I don't think anyone would begrudge you that, but you might punish yourself for it.
Yeah.
But there's a different thing between doing that, taking on like a TV show where you have to be somebody, where you have to work for somebody with an agenda, and then when you write your own show.
Yeah.
But when you write your own show, what you're serving is what you think is funny. You're not sitting there thinking how much of this is accessible, how much of it isn't.
You're not a sellout. I hate that term because, you know, the two people who are jealous of your success will call you a sellout. Yeah. People who understand what you're saying will say, you know what, he's experimenting, he's doing different stuff, he's trying his hand at this. And there's a huge difference between doing television and doing radio and doing stand-up.
I love comics. I've had comics come to shows I've done recently and go, yeah, I see you giving them what they want.
Do you feel shitty about that?
Typical.
I didn't feel good about myself.
Yeah, like I'm not.
I had to take a bath.
I've still got a friend. She's still a friend of mine. She had to produce like a series of interviews about this really shitty politician, and she had to try and make her look good. This politician,
right?
And it just she was so embarrassed by the whole thing. And that's kind of, in a way, I suppose, selling out. But again, I don't blame her.
It's a job. The selling out in comedy is when you don't serve something you feel truthful.
Yeah, but why is that something artists feel bad about, but accountants don't?
No.
Like if the accountant has to sit up working on Steinhoff's
it was an irregularity.
Report. Listen, if he has to work on Steinhoff's report, and he knows he's giving them the truth, and then they're going to twist it. He doesn't feel bad about that. He just doesn't want to go to jail. Yes. How come the artist sits in bed in agony going, oh, why did I do that thing that was selling out, that was too commercial? This isn't me.
Because the artist's job is to sit in bed in agony. Everything else is whatever.
I think what's when you have the feeling on stage of having delivered something that is entirely authentic and truthful, it sounds like flowery, but what happens is energetically it just feels way better.
Yeah, of course.
It's interesting because this show, Fortified, was kind of a departure from shows that I did a lot of political stuff and impersonations.
Great segue into plugging the show because we haven't done that yet. So
we can't actually plug the show because I think it's sold out.
Is it so?
But there's
out?
Another one coming
Shit,
in September.
Mazel tov.
But anyway, but I got asked this question this morning, like, oh, there's so much. This is the worst. And they go, oh, you got so much material. What's going on in this country at the moment? I mean, it's, if I had a rand. and actually, I was like, I want to talk about the time my dad died. Sounds like there was more than one. It might have been, actually. When they did the heart, anyway,
yes,
and on the last day of his life, I borrowed his fleece and discovered $10,000 in his pocket, and then he had a heart attack and died, and they took him away, and I tell the story on stage, and people always want to know what happened with the money. Telling that story is like
they're not interested.
The favorite part of my
how
show.
How did you feel about your dad dying? They're like,
but it took me 7 years to work out how to do that.
And
material.
That's a true story.
Yeah. And then they brought his body back from the morgue, and I had to go through the pocket. You know, talking about that.
Yes, there was more.
Yeah.
But it is. It's because in stand-up, you have to sort of travel, go on a journey to come back to yourself. And then if you're not being completely authentic, it doesn't matter. You will know before anyone has told you that you have sold yourself in a way that is not about being a sellout, like taking on a commercial.
Mm-hmm.
But on the stage, like that's the only thing you're supposed to do is authentically.
I've said this 1,000 times. It bears repeating because I haven't really had you two in for a conversation like this before. But I've always maintained the most difficult of the performing arts is doing stand-up comedy for various reasons. But the most obvious one is that your audience give you immediate feedback. And sometimes they're not polite about it. If you go to the ballet and someone's cuck, you don't stand up and start throwing shit at them.
I was going to say, I think ballet is the hardest performing art.
No,
if you try to put your toe.
Cuck. No. Because even if you're bad at it, the audience is not going to get up and walk out in a tantrum.
It's not the hardest thing. It's just the one that makes you feel the most shit if you get it wrong.
Stand up is the toughest thing in the world. I would never. Once I think I tried it as a kind of experiment. So easily one of the most scary things I've ever done. I would never do that again. I'm blown away that you get up there and you do sometimes brand new material for the first time in front of an audience of people who are paying you to make them laugh, which is an involuntary thing. So it's not like they can come in with the intention to, or the.
Yeah,
sometimes they come in with exactly the opposite intention because they've had a terrible day and they hate their job and they're getting relationship shit from somebody. And then, okay, you, I've paid good money. You make me laugh.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, actually, what's interesting is when you get to the point where you've developed a kind of following, when they're paying to see, it's often easier because they are, and it can be tricky because they're ready to laugh. In fact, they're already laughing.
Yes.
And you, so you're not sure actually how good this new stuff really is versus being on a lineup where they didn't necessarily to come see you, or being at a corporate where they really don't, like, who the hell... What is this guy doing here?
Yeah, you're in between difference. The awards, or they're busy eating while you're up there. God, that's annoying. Huh?
Which, I did this gig.
Knives and forks clanging, and you're busy trying to be funny.
7th of January. It's never agreed to do a show on the 7th of January for a billionaire in Cape Town. And they put me... The golden rule of comedy is like be able to touch the audience.
Mm.
Like be able to touch the person in the front row. If you're like 5 meters away, you're already screwed. So the stage is like 10 meters away. It started raining.
Oh no.
As I went on, it started raining. They were putting up umbrellas for half of my set. People were like, oh, the salmon. And then I felt like I was starting out. I felt like it was... 15 years ago.
Where do you test your material out?
I've got a couple of venues in Cape Town. One is in the Deep South, in a place called Noordhoek.
Deep South.
The Deep South. And,
so
and
far
it's, like,
it's on the,
it's 100-seater.
Other side of the mountain.
It's got low ceilings. This is the other thing about comedy. Low ceilings. You need low ceilings. And it's 100 people there, and I'll do like 3 nights. Yeah, obviously, there's comedy clubs in between. Go and test. But when I need to put an hour together, that's my favorite place.
And what do you do?
In Joburg, the best places are the smaller clubs, which is like on a Monday night, we've got a gig called, it's at Poppy's in Melville.
Mm-hmm.
Every Monday night, it's a new material night. It's a free comedy night. And actually, over the last like 2 years or couple of years, it's almost always full. It's interesting. It's like just a back room of a restaurant.
We've got a lot of people who love comedy in this country and they support it.
Yeah.
Thank God we've got the venues, right?
Yeah, well, it started and comics will have started to open their own rooms, which is good. So Monday night at Poppy's, Tuesday night at Kitchener's in Braamfontein. That's a great show. Mm. And it's packed every week. Every week. That's like a 50 rand show. And that's where most of the comics try out
on
their
Wednesday.
New material.
What's on Wednesday?
Wednesday is Shakers in
Mamelodi. Thursday?
Thursday is at...
Come on, Gilly. Don't let me down.
Greenside.
Yeah, Friday. Do you perform on Shabbos?
Friday. We don't have small rooms on Friday, but I do perform on Shabbos. Don't tell anybody.
Saturday.
Goliath Club in Braamfontein has just opened. That's new.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday.
And at Melrose Arch. Sunday is Pop Art in Mabonnet.
She often does 18 shows a week.
And that's pushing it. But close.
Gilly's been doing stand-up for, what is it now, about a year and a half?
Just over 2 years.
Just over 2 years. And religiously, like, this is how you grow your stuff. She's on stage often, like, at least once a night.
Jeez, yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
If not more.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I was on stage, I did 180 gigs last year.
Wow.
But that's like, because I couldn't find even any more to be on.
That's how you become brilliant.
It's the only way. You can't have that. You can't have, when you want to know why you shit, it can't be because you didn't work hard enough. You know?
Yeah, but man, you can tell me, because I'm sure it's happened to both of you. There's got to be very little in the world that's as awful as bombing on stage in comedy. Yes, it must be heart-wrenching.
It's pretty.
Hopefully it doesn't happen often, but I mean, when it happens, because it happens to the best people in the universe, right?
You know what? You don't realize how people think it's this thing, or it could go well, or it could go badly. If you reach a certain level of proficiency, like you get to a certain level of consistently good performances. And so that somebody like a bombing for Nick is not my idea of a bomb. My idea of a bomb is like still like no one laughs. For Nick, it'll be, oh, no one is like, not everyone is laughing hysterically.
Yeah,
and
sure.
That's a bomb for
it's
him.
Like a,
so it's like
a 5-star Michelin chef will say, "Oh, well, the vinegar wasn't drizzled in the appropriate way." Most people wouldn't notice that. Chef.
Yes,
he's going from good to great.
Yes,
whereas you might still occasionally because he's just started
often,
out,
no, very
have
often.
Those below average ones, and you're like, "Oh, that's a disaster."
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. I go through lots of disasters, but you have to be. For me, it's almost like the experience of doing it is the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be.
Do you think that Donald Trump is very dangerous?
I feel like we have to wait and see.
Potentially.
Not tremendously. Tremendously dangerous. Believe me. Really dangerous. All right, listen. Guys, thank you. I can't believe we've been talking for like an hour. Feels like 5 minutes.
Okay.
And the show, Fortified, running in Joburg from the 16th to 20th January. If it's sold out, sorry. We still got to hear a little bit of Nick now.
Friday night. You know what? I know there's tickets on Friday night because a lot of the Jews are just like, why is he doing?
Get them while they're hot.
We're not coming.
Get them. Now.
Get them. Get it. Right. Get some.
And Gilly gave us a whole lineup of where you could find her. You're going to be working as hard this year?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Harder.
So you're doing your thing.
Awesome.
Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks, guys. Nick Rabinowitz and Gilly, I forgot your surname, Apta. There we go. Very good. Love to see you guys, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
This is CliffCentral.com.